My name is Gordon Carpenter. I'm the Director of Student Ministries here at Horizon, and we will be in 2 Samuel chapter 2. So if you have your copies of God's Word, go ahead and turn there. If you don't worry, because we'll have the text on the screen. We're continuing our sermon series through the book of 2 Samuel, and this is a weird one. This chapter in and of itself is weird. Not a lot of consequence in the story as a whole happens. Basically, 2 Samuel chapter 2 takes place like this. David comes back into Israel's territories. He builds some bridges in the north. But while David is in the south, a new king, who is not David and is not God's anointed, is appointed in the north. So David's in the south, this new king is in the north, and then the armies of David and the armies of this new king fight a battle, and essentially that battle basically ends in a draw, and our chapter concludes with the armies of the north going back to the north and the armies in the south going back to the south. So not a ton happens in this chapter, and yet we will be here this morning together. Before we dive in, I got a few opening questions for you guys, and don't worry, they are rhetorical. If this was hype in the youth group, I would make you answer me, but it's rhetorical. So what comes to mind when you hear the term election year? It's giggles. Are you filled with hope and wonder at the prospect of a new president coming to right the wrongs? Are you filled with dread at the prospect of someone either remaining in power or freshly coming into power that will wreck all the advancements in progress? When thinking of the candidates in an election year, do you spend the majority of your time complaining, whining, bad-mouthing, spewing on social media or to your family or friends or coworkers about the absurdity of insert candidate here? Does the mere term election year from the pulpit or the table this morning have your heart racing or sweat pouring or face reddening? Maybe not in the first service, but definitely in the second service. I can see some emails already being formulated to send me later, and I haven't even preached yet. But don't worry, this sermon is not political. I'm not going to conclude it politically. Truthfully, I don't think the pulpit is the place for political punditry. How's that for alliteration? And before you have an aneurysm this morning at what you think I might say as I introduce the sermon like this, let me give you the main point now of this chapter and where we're going to end. Imperfect leaders make imperfect decisions. And those decisions have far-reaching consequences. The title of this sermon is Imperfect Men Make Imperfect Leaders. It's not pithy like I normally try to do, but it is pointed. Contextually, where are we in the story of 2 Samuel? Well, we're in a point in Israelite history where the monarchy of Israel is well established. Israel has rejected God as their king. God has God anointed a man named Saul to be king over them. But then Saul sinned, the throne was taken from him, and a new king was anointed. That new king is David. But for the last several years, David is not with God's people. Can we pull up the map? It's going to be a lot of switching. So for the last several years, David is in Philistia. Look at the west. He's been running from Saul, who's trying to kill him, so it's at least understandable in our human minds why he's in the west. He's not been ruling God's people. And more immediately still, he hasn't just been abiding in Philistia. He has allied himself with the Philistines. Allied himself with God's people, or God's enemies. Sorry, big difference. He has allied himself with God's enemies. And here's the point. Anytime throughout the whole Bible, when God's people ally or align themselves with God's enemies, horrible consequences follow. All throughout the Torah, when God's people align themselves with God's enemies, consequences follow. The judges, same thing. All throughout the monarchies, however long we're in, the kings in Israelite history, we'll see that. Throughout the prophets, when God's people align themselves with God's enemies, consequences follow. And while David was fighting for the Philistines kill King Saul. and most of his sons. Last week we preached, or Joe preached, on what happened when David found out that Saul and Jonathan was dead. David took vengeance out on a man who lyingly said he killed God's anointed, and then David wrote a ballad of lament and remorse over the death of Saul, God's true anointed. This week, and for the next several weeks, I'm guessing, we're going to be in a story of David's ascension to the throne. And finally, I know this is long-winded, but this is going to serve us well for the rest of this series in 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel is different than 1 Samuel. What's the first question we ask every time we come to a text of Scripture? What's the genre? And then we ask other questions as well, but the first question we ask is, what's the genre? 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel are both narrative. 1 Samuel is what's known as serial narrative, meaning it's a series of events. 1 Samuel is really easy to follow. One event follows the next, follows the next, follows the next, chronologically straightforward, so it's really easy to follow. 2 Samuel is what's known as episodic narrative, so episodes. It is one story, but it's not necessarily sequential. 2 Samuel will jump around a lot, and these episodes are self-contained stories in a larger story. It's way more helpful in our context to think of it like this. If 2 Samuel is a TV show, the entire thing is a TV show. There are seasons in this TV show. And these seasons, these episodes, have their own point to them. So this morning, why we're only in 2 Samuel 2, we are looking at the first part of one season of an entire TV show. So if there feels like there's a lot of buildup in this sermon and not a lot of payoff, it's because there is. There's not a lot of payoff, and Joe gets the payoff later. So are you guys with me? Does that make sense? It's going to help the rest of this series if we think of it as episodic or seasons. There we go. Look with me now at God's word. You heard the summary, but we're going to read it and go through it together. In verse 1, it begins like this. After this, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah?" And the Lord said to David, "Go up." And David said, "To which shall I go up?" And he said, "To Hebron." So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam of Jezreel, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David brought up his men who were with him, everyone with his household, and they lived in the towns of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. So our text this morning begins with the phrase, after this. After what? Well, after David hears of the death of King Saul, after David mourns the death of King Saul and Jonathan, writes the ballad. In chapter 1, we're told that David waited 3 days before he did everything. That was a self-contained episode. This is a new episode. After this is like a new season of the show is starting. And we don't know how long he waited. It could have been on the fourth day, or it could have been months and months later. It could have been years later. At some point after David heard of the death of Saul and Jonathan, living in Philistia, he inquires of God, "Should I go up into the cities of Judah?" Now, depending on who you read, lots of people take this as like a paradigm of the Christian life. Even in the little things, David is inquiring of God what he should do next. And that's, if you want to read it like that, you can. I don't read it like that. Why don't I read it like that? Well, in 1 Samuel, David is the anointed king. In 1 Samuel, the throne has been ripped from Saul. The end of 1 Samuel, Saul dies. So who is the king of Israel right now? According to God, David. Who has the duties of the king of Israel right now, according to God? David. Who is responsible for governing the people of Israel right now? The anointed king, David. And where is he? He's in Philistine territory. God has clearly laid out what he wants of David. And David asks the question, "God, what should I do?" We can look at this as David inquiring of the Lord over little things, and it could be the paradigm of our life. We should inquire and ask God and seek God's counsel. But maybe that thing you're praying about, God has already been very clear on what he wants you to do. God says, go up. And David said, to which shall I go up? That's a stupid question. You should already be there. God tells him to go to Hebron. Now, if you look at this map, do you see in the southwest kind of, there's a star by the land of Hebron? Okay, so if you know anything about like fantasy shows or movies or sci-fi fantasy shows, movies or books, in the early chapters of early seasons, early episodes, early scenes of these books, movies, TV shows, there's this thing called world building. Well, good showrunners and good authors and good directors do world building. What this means is they introduce the world and the setting of the story which is going to take place. That's what's happening here. 2 Samuel is not fantasy or sci-fi or fictitious even. It is episodic narrative. It's historical. It's inerrant. I get that. But the author of it is doing a really good job of world building. Hebron, with the star, is essentially at this point the capital of Judah. Judah is in the south. Israel is in the north. At this point in the history of God's people, Jerusalem is occupied. Jerusalem is not the capital. Later in the story, David's going to capture Jerusalem and found the capital there. But right now, David goes from Philistia into Hebron, the stronghold of the southern kingdom. Does that make sense? And we're told he brings all of his men and wives with him. And in the end of verse 4, we are told that he is again anointed David, that again David is anointed king over the house of Judah. This is the second time of three that David will be anointed. Verse 4b continues. When they, people of Hebron, told David it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul, David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, may you be blessed by the Lord because you showed this loyalty to Saul, your Lord, and buried him. Now may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you. And I will do good to you because you have done this thing. Now therefore, let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul, your Lord, is dead. And the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. So if we go back to the map, at the top in the north, there's a place, Jabesh-Gilead. That is, it's a Benjamite territory. That's where Saul is from. So Saul dies at the hands of the Philistines. The Philistines desecrate his body, but the men of his house go get his body and give him proper burial rites. David finds out about this. All the way in the south, David finds out about this. And what does he do? He makes a pretty ingenious political move. He sends emissaries to the north with blessing and compliments and promises of prosperity. You guys did a great thing. I'm so proud of you. God's really proud of you. God's going to bless you in doing that. And I am going to bless you in doing that because you buried your king. Oh, and by the way, I'm king now. I'm king in the south, and I'm going to benefit you and bless you and give you all these things. Just so you know, David is building bridges. So what's happening here? It's political. David is forced to play a political game because of a power vacuum that happens in the north. Before this, Israel is one nation, 12 tribes, one nation. Saul dies. And the next king is David, but David's not even in the country. Because David is not even in the country, again, a power vacuum happens. So when David finally does his duty and comes back into the country, he has to play a game of politics. This is the first of the consequences of David's imperfect choices. We're told that he is anointed over the house of Judah. This is prelude or foreshadowing of the civil war. Which again is another consequence of failed and imperfect actions of men. Verse 8. But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. And he, Abner, made him, Ishbosheth, king over Gilead, and the Asherites, and Jezreel, and Ephraim, and Benjamin, and all Israel. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. But the house of Judah followed David, and the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. So, we have a new character introduced. We know Abner a little bit from 1 Samuel. Who is Abner? He is Saul's cousin. He's Saul's kin. He is the commander of Saul's armies. In his introduction in 2 Samuel, he is cunning. He is wise. He is power hungry. And he is loyal to a fault. What does Abner do? Well, in this power vacuum, because he's wise and cunning and power hungry and loyal to a fault, he seizes the opportunity of this power vacuum and appoints his own king. Now, when Israel first asked God for a king, they said they wanted a king like the nations. The motivation for having a king was everybody else does it, so that's what we want. And the way that everybody else did it, and the way that monarchies have passed basically ubiquitously throughout history, has been through the bloodline. So Abner says, okay, all these other kings, their monarchy flows through the bloodline. So who is next in line since Saul and most of his sons died? Oh, well, Saul has a son named Abner, or Saul has a son named Ishbosheth. I'll make him king in the north. Again, an imperfect choice that will lead to consequences. We'll read later that Abner knows that David is the Lord's anointed. We'll read later that Abner knows that David is supposed to be the king. Abner is purposefully splitting the kingdom. Who does he split the kingdom for? Who is the king? Well, we have another character introduced in this opening episode, Ishbosheth. We read that Ishbosheth is the son of Saul. Now, in 1 Samuel 31, when Saul dies, it says the Philistines killed Saul and his sons. And it's implied that it's all his sons. And if you read just 1 Samuel, you'll think it's all of his sons. But we see that he has at least one other son who didn't go to war. We read that Ishbosheth is 40 years old, and he's still alive. Here's a fun fact about Ishbosheth. If you read 1-2 Samuel and 1-2 Chronicles together, they tell the same stories in different ways. Ishbosheth in 1-2 Chronicles is Ishbaal. You guys know the false deity in the Old Testament, Baal? So Baal, if you know, kurios in Greek just means Lord. It can be a deity or it can just be a term of like respect. Baal is the same in Hebrew. Baal means Lord or master. God is called Baal a couple times in the Old Testament. Baal, like the proper false deity Baal, we see it in Numbers, we see it in Judges, but really isn't a big deal until Ahab and Jezebel's story later in the monarchies, where like Jezebel brings in proper Phoenician Canaanite Baal worship. Well, between 1 Samuel and 1-2 Samuel, 1-2 Chronicles, an editor came back and took Ishbaal, which means man of the Lord, and changed his name to Ishbosheth, which means man of shame. Why? Well, they didn't want to associate with the false deity Baal, but I think there's more to it than that. Ishbosheth is set up as pretty much a coward. Saul and his sons go to war. Saul and his sons, for all of their faults, are brave. Saul and his sons do their duty, but not the man of shame. Not this 40-year-old coward who doesn't go to war, who lets other men fight his battles for him. And he is set up, this man of shame. Where is he set up? We read that he is set up in a city called Mahanaim. So if you look kind of in the middle to the right, I guess northeast in the green area, you see a star with a circle in it, and there's Mahanaim. This isn't new to you guys, even though you think it might be. Mahanaim has come up at least once before in the Old Testament. You remember the story of Jacob and Esau? Jacob runs away from Esau after stealing Esau's birthright. He lives with Laban for 14 years, gets a couple wives, and wants to come back and reunite with Esau. So as Jacob is bringing all of his people back to Esau, he's really scared of Esau. And as he's traveling this distance to his brother, the Bible in the book of Genesis says that Jacob and his people saw a camp of angels. It's this weird throwaway verse. And it could be warning, it could be comfort, depending on how you read it. So Jacob calls the place where he sees this camp of angels Mahanaim, which means two camps, my camp and the camp of angels. It means two camps. It means two armies. It means two nations. Do you see that? You see the irony here? Abner is setting up a false king in the city that literally means two nations. Abner knows what he's doing. He's splitting Israel. He's making an imperfect choice. We read that Abner and Ishbosheth ruled over Israel for 2 years, while David ruled for 7 years and 6 months. How do you rationalize that timeline? This is the battle, and what we're about to read probably takes place at the end of David's rule of just Judah. King in the south, finally trying to get back on track, following God's will for him. False king in the north, setting up prelude to civil war. Read with me in verse 12. Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab, new character, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, the one on the one side and the other on the other side. And Abner said to Joab, "Let the young men arise and compete before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." Then they, the young men, arose and passed over by number 12 for Benjamin and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And each caught his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side, so they fell down together. Therefore, that place was called Helkath Hazarim, which is at Gibeon. And the battle was fierce that day. And Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of Saul. This is a really weird portion of this chapter, which is already a really weird portion of the Bible. So, king in the north, false king in the north, in Mahanaim. True king in the south, in Hebron, two capital cities. The commander of the northern king, Abner, takes his men to Gibeon, which is kind of centrally located in the green, right above the brown. It's a mountain. And we read that Joab, new character introduced, who's the commander of David's armies, brings David's armies up to battle. Now, Joab and Abner are pretty comparable just on the head. They're both commanders of their king's armies. Joab is related to David. Joab is fierce and wise and cunning and loyal, just like Abner. So these two armies meet. And Abner, who doesn't want to fight, says, "Hey, let the young men arise and compete." This Hebrew word compete, it brings with it like gladiatorial. I think that's how you say that word. Gladiator games? Gladiatorial? I don't know. Like gladiator. Gladiator. Oh my goodness, thank you. We'd lost an hour of sleep last night, y'all. Gladiator, thanks, Shamgar. This word compete in Hebrew has like gladiator. Gladiator, sorry, I'm not saying this in the second service. It has like gladiator game imagery. And so Abner says, "Hey, I don't want to fight you. You don't want to fight us. Let's have a champion battle." Remember David and Goliath? David represents Israel, Goliath represents the Philistines, and the champions fight. Well, this is the same thing, except instead of 1v1, it's 12v12, and it's fitting that it's 12v12, because how many tribes are there in Israel? 12. So Abner's like, "These 12 men represent the true kingdom of Israel." And Joab's like, "All right, my 12 men represent the true kingdom of Israel." And they fight. And now, the Hebrew here, it's even translated in English, it's highly stylized writing. I don't think it was as like black and white as 12 men lined up across from a river and each one grabbed the other person at the same time and just stabbed each other. That's not how people fight. If you've ever watched anyone fight ever, they don't just let each other grab them. It's stylized writing, and basically the whole point is they fight to a draw. The 12 champions of Joab and the 12 champions of Abner all die. And since it's a draw, there's no clear winner in this champion battle. Full battle is joined. And Abner's army is forced back by David and Joab's army. This civil war, or this skirmish and a prelude to civil war, ensues because of imperfect choices of imperfect men. And men die as pawns in the literal game, compete game, of their commanders as a consequence. And again, if this was an episode of a TV show, our next scene begins in verse 18. The three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. Joab has two brothers, and we read that Asahel was swift of foot as a wild gazelle. And Asahel, who's also related to David, pursued Abner. And as he went, he turned neither to the right hand nor to the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, "Is it you, Asahel?" And he said, "It is I." So after this champion battle, there's a draw. There's a real battle is joined. Abner is forced to retreat. And the men of Israel, or the men of Judah, Joab, David's army, gives pursuit. And Asahel is one man who's faster than everybody else. So we read that he is sprinting after Abner, not just the army. He's going to cut the head off the snake. We read that he doesn't turn to the left or the right, which just means he is hell-bent and focused on just getting to Abner. And again, this is more stylized writing. So I don't know how Abner is sprinting full out and shouting behind him, "Asahel, is that you?" But the point is, Abner knows Asahel by name. All of these men fought together for Saul. Think of our own civil war. Brother against brother. Father against son. Friend against friend. Consequences of imperfect actions by imperfect leaders. And Abner knows by name this man who is pursuing him to kill him. All because of imperfect choices. Verse 21, Abner said to him, "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left and seize one of the young men and take his spoil. Don't come after me. I'm the commander. I should have leniency. You don't attack the commanders, you attack the foot soldiers." But Asahel would not turn aside from following him, hell-bent, dogged in his pursuit. And Abner said again to Asahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab?" He doesn't just know Asahel, he knows his brother. And this is not, "Oh, me and your brother are buddies." I don't know if you guys will remember this. When we did David and Goliath, there's a thing called blood revenge. Think Hatfields and McCoys. I kill you, your brother kills me, my cousin kills your uncle kills my dad, and then that. So he's scared of blood revenge. Even though this is tragic because he knows him by name and he probably is friends, his friendship is not motivating him here. It's fear that's motivating him here. But Asahel, verse 23, refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the stomach with the butt of his spear so that the spear came out of his back. And he fell there and died where he was. And all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. Luke, you'll know this move. In basketball, if you're posting up and I'm playing defense on you, and Luke's way bigger than me and he's backing me down and backing me down and backing me down, I can pull the chair. Meaning as soon as he uses his momentum and all of his size advantage over me to drive into me, if I just back away, his momentum, not him because he's super athletic and he'll catch himself, but anybody else, their momentum would force them to fall over. Abner, basically a cunning, wise warrior getting pursued by a much younger and much more handsome man, uses Asahel's momentum against him. "Stop pursuing me. No, I'm not going to. Please stop pursuing me. No, I'm not going to." So he takes his spear and stops and lets his Asahel's own momentum force him onto the spear. And we read that the army of Joab stopped to pay respect. And you think that is the end. But it's not. Verse 24, Joab and Abishai, brothers of Asahel, pursued Abner without their army. And as the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Ammah, which lies before Gia on the way to the wilderness of Gibeon. And the people of Benjamin gathered themselves together behind Abner and became one group and took their stand on top of the hill. So Joab's army stops to pay respect for this fallen captain. This fallen captain's two brothers force ahead, blood revenge, manic with wrath, pursuing Abner. And these two men finally catch up to Abner when Abner catches up and regroups with his whole army. Abner finally looks around with his whole army, sees only two men pursuing him, takes a seat at an advantageous place at the top of a hill. He's got the high ground, shout out Obi-Wan Kenobi, and he looks at the two men pursuing him, and he says this. Verse 26, Abner called to Joab, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you know that the end will be bitter? How long will it be before you tell your people to turn aside from the pursuit of their brothers?" And Joab said, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely the men would not have given up the pursuit of their brothers until the morning." So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the men stopped and pursued Israel no more, nor did they fight anymore. Abner, again, is wise and cunning, and he shows some wisdom and mercy here. He could easily have killed Joab and Abishai. But he says, "Hey, how long are we going to fight? How long will brother pursue brother?" One scholar I read this week said that this is paradigmatic of Christendom and of God's people. We are prone to infighting. And if you know the history of God's people in the Bible, there's tons of civil war. If you know the history of God's people all throughout the Middle Ages, Reformation, there's tons of infighting. And if you know anything about all of the plethora of denominations today, we are a schismatic people. And I'm not saying there is a place for theological unity, but there is a place for unity. Again, verse 28, Joab blew the trumpet and all the men stopped and pursued Israel no more, nor did they fight anymore. This is a pretty anticlimactic ending to our episode. This giant battle takes place after a champion battle takes place. And then the captain of one army is like, "Hey, stop." And the captain of the other army is like, "Okay." And that's pretty much all that happens. Read with me verse 29 and following, because they just go back to their own camps. Abner and his men went all that night through the Arabah, and they crossed the Jordan, marching the whole morning. They came to Mahanaim. So they're back where they started. Joab returned from the pursuit of Abner when he gathered all of his people. There were missing from David's servants 19 men besides Asahel. But the servants of David had struck down of Benjamin 360 of Abner's men. And they took up Asahel and buried him in the tomb of his father, which was at Bethlehem. And Joab marched all night, and the day broke upon them at Hebron. So after this battle, Abner just goes back to Mahanaim. And after this battle, Joab just goes back to Hebron. Nothing happens with resolution. Except, oh, my brother died. 20 of my men died. 360 of your men died. And where did it get us? Nowhere. We're literally back where we started from. All this death, and for what? Verse 1 of chapter 3, we're only going to do one verse of chapter 3, don't worry. There was long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. Actions have consequences. long war. And David was supposed to be this great unifier who was going to come in and unite all the 12 tribes of Israel. And he does that for a time. And then we know the history of God's people. There is civil war again. Even in this cliffhanger, before the next episode begins of our season, we see that imperfect choices wreak devastating consequences. Even for David, the hashtag make Israel great again guy, Israel's superhero, imperfect. So getting back to the title and the questions at the beginning. What does come to mind during an election year? Man, this is the time. We're finally going to make America great. Man, this is the time. We're going to finish the job. So much of campaign media is focused on giving hope. And yet, when I asked the questions at the beginning, most of you sniggered when I asked if you had hope. Psalm 146 says, put not your trust in princes, in a son of man in whom there is no salvation. You see, we know that imperfect men will always make imperfect decisions. I hope your hopes this morning are not resting on your candidate winning. We don't need a king like the nations. We don't need a president like the nations. Trust in the rising and the falling of your candidate is idolatry. Putting your hopes in whether your candidate wins or loses is idolatry. Likewise, all of your efforts and all of your time spent spewing about the other candidate and complaining about the other candidate every time he does something you hate is equally idolatry. It's not worship, but it's focus. Too much focus on a human, fallen, fallible, imperfect leader. I'm not saying don't be active in the civil sphere. I'm not saying to not vote. I'm not telling you who to vote for. I'm saying no matter what happens, if your candidate loses, if your candidate wins, every imperfect leader will make imperfect decisions. And if our hope is in imperfect men, our hope is futile. And I don't know if this sermon is going to resound with you throughout this entire election season. But maybe for just this week, or maybe even for just today, we can shift our minds and our hopes into the Son of Man, the perfect man, perfectly obedient, the true great unifier, the only leader who will not fail. And oh, by the way, his actions have consequences too, although they are perfect. What are the consequences of the actions of Jesus? Our salvation. We talked about the schismatic nature of God's people. Well, there's coming a day when there will be no longer any schism of God's people. There's coming a day when we will be unified under one banner and under one king. Could you shift your mind and your attention, even for today, in gratitude for him?